This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This podcast is a production of Nuanced Tales in partnership with WFAE, distributed by the NPR network. It contains some strong language. Listener discretion advised.
The President of the United States and the former Governor of California are scrounging desperately for one delegate here and one delegate there.
Politics can get embarrassing. If you're a candidate dedicated to victory, sometimes the question is how much humiliation will you take?
Reagan's shuttling back and forth between meeting rooms in a Fargo motel.
How far will you stray from your values?
Ford campaign officials claim they have not been making any deals with uncommitted delegates.
How low will you go? It was summer, and the primaries had ended after six grueling months. Neither Ronald Reagan nor Gerald Ford had won. They were both just short of the nomination. So now they were scraping for what was left. About 150 delegates would enter the Republican National Convention unbound. Under the party's convoluted rules, they could vote for whoever they wanted. The uncommitted delegates would tip the nomination. Reagan was traveling the country to personally lobby each one to vote for him. It was miserable.
God, what a price we paid.
His confidant, Michael Deaver, in an old scratchy interview, laughed, recalling,
"We were in this cut-off Ramada Inn or something, Reagan in this little tiny bedroom with a double bed, sitting across the bed, and one-on-one talked to every Mississippi delegate."
Gerald Ford felt more comfortable back in the White House. But the executive mansion may as well have been a hotel, recalls White House photographer David Kennerly.
They were entertaining up the wazoo. I have no idea how many people slept in the Lincoln bedroom.
The delegates were bused to the White House for cocktails and hors d'oeuvres.
Being an uncommitted delegate, President of the United States was going to personally meet with you, almost guaranteed.
Ford clawed for every delegate. Reagan clawed for every delegate. Both of them were desperate. They had come so far, they could see victory if they could just get a few more votes. And they were determined they would, no matter what, even if it was humiliating.
An almost desperate battle for the final few delegates.
Or sordid.
Some delegates seeking special favors in return for their support.
Or a bit ridiculous.
Ford told her that he would commit himself to a National Grandmother's Day if he...
The press followed every move like a tennis match, announcing the delegates' score every evening.
Mr. Ford has 1,106. Reagan has 1,037.
This was a silly episode in American politics. And also, sadly, an important inflection point for the Republican Party and eventually the country. This is the story of the final days of the race between Reagan and Ford, the petty maneuverings, the last-minute gambits, and the betrayals that decided the nomination in an ultra-close race. The Republican convention, where it all peaked, has become known as the shootout in Kansas City. It not only decided the nomination, through an often absurd series of events, it cemented a venerable American political party as a conservative party. This is Landslide. I'm Ben Bradford. Ronald Reagan felt every one of his 65 years as he sank into the comfort of his California ranch. He'd come home from the most exhausting campaign of his life and the degrading hunt for delegates, still just shy of the nomination, while Ford kept climbing toward it.
Some uncommitted delegates from Virginia and New York now have decided to go public for President Ford.
More than 16 delegates had joined him, including two who'd previously supported Reagan.
Reagan couldn't compete with Ford's incumbency, the power of his office, the favors he could offer.
Ford said today he is very close to locking up the Republican presidential nomination.
Reagan was just a few dozen votes away out of a couple thousand, but he could not see a way to get them, says his political director, Charlie Black.
We were going to lose if we didn't come up with some creative way to break loose some of those delegates.
And then the doorbell rang. Standing outside Reagan's home was his 36-year-old campaign manager, John Sears. He'd flown in from D.C. Sears came in, excited, with a new plan to get the delegates. He called for Reagan to immediately announce a running mate. That was unheard of, ahead of the convention, far outside of tradition. And Sears knew who Reagan should choose to change everything. His earth-shattering vice presidential choice would be, get ready, Richard Schweiker. If you're thinking, who? You are forgiven. Richard Schweiker was not an especially distinguished U.S. senator, but he was from Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania had uncommitted delegates, enough to decide the nomination, if only they weren't backing Gerald Ford. Schweiker suggested if he became Reagan's running mate, the delegates would switch from Ford to Reagan too, giving Reagan the nomination. There was only one risk. Schweiker was a liberal Republican.
Richard Schweiker is so liberal that the Americans for Democratic Action last year gave him a score of 89%, an organization most Reagan conservatives consider to be a bunch of dangerous radicals.
Reagan's promise at the start of his campaign was to make the Republican Party a conservative party.
Raising a banner of bold colors, no pale pastels.
Picking Schweiker would fly in the face of that. Also, Reagan had just pledged not to make this kind of pick.
Earlier this month, Ronald Reagan said, "I don't believe in picking someone at the opposite end of the political spectrum because he can get some votes that you can't get yourself."
That had been hypothetical. But now, Reagan considered, how far would he go to win? Would he stray from his values? He decided quickly. 2 days later, Reagan called a press conference.
"Since I now feel that the people and the delegates have a right to know in advance of the convention who a nominee's vice presidential choice would be, I am today departing from tradition and announcing my selection. I have chosen the distinguished United States Senator from Pennsylvania, the Honorable Richard Schweiker."
The audience was stunned. Quickly, everyone from reporters to the president wondered, had Reagan done it? Had the movie star delivered a political masterstroke worthy of Hollywood? Would choosing Schweiker catapult him from the brink of defeat to capturing the nomination? It would not.
"I will not assist in selling this opportunistic team to the Republican delegates."
Reagan's conservative supporters exploded in fury.
"Well, I just felt sold out."
Delegates renounced him.
"I just couldn't support that ticket any longer."
Reagan had betrayed them, betrayed the new right.
"We were pretty unhappy."
Carter Wren, who you heard last episode helping Reagan's comeback in North Carolina.
"Schweiker was not a conservative. We wanted a conservative party. We wanted a conservative movement."
Still, the anger would be worth it. If Schweiker could deliver the delegates he'd promised, Reagan would win the nomination. News cameras caught the senator on the phone, urging his colleagues in Pennsylvania to switch with him.
"I think that Governor Reagan has made a bold, decisive move."
But Schweiker had overestimated his sway.
"CBS News has done a poll of the Pennsylvania delegation that reveals that the only delegate that has shifted support from Mr. Ford to Reagan is Richard Schweiker."
The plan had failed. Reagan had sold out for nothing. He was no closer to the nomination. All he'd done was upset his own supporters. But Reagan wasn't done fighting. Picking Schweiker was just one plan to get the delegates he needed for the nomination. It was the first of three plans Reagan would ultimately adopt. And together, these plans would throw the 1976 Republican convention into chaos. His campaign manager, John Sears, was already working on plan number two. Featuring just a paragraph of text and Richard Schweiker again, this plan created the defining conflict of the shootout in Kansas City. In the days leading up to the convention, hotel conference rooms around Kansas City filled with cigarette smoke, body heat, and raised voices. The Ford and Reagan camps were hammering out the terms of engagement for the convention, everything from the run of schedule to what the party's platform would say. Reagan's campaign manager, John Sears, quietly slipped into perhaps the sleepiest of these committees. The GOP Rules Committee was discussing minutiae when they noticed him.
Let's welcome Chairman Sears. I didn't realize he was with us.
Sears said he was there to offer one slight change to the convention rules, one paragraph.
And I really see nothing that's going to disrupt the convention. It's a very simple resolution.
He broke into a grin because he was clearly lying. This paragraph was plan number two to get Reagan the nomination. Although it seemed innocuous, the text of it required both candidates to do what Reagan had already done with Schweiker, announce running mates before the nomination.
The vice president must not be perceived as being thrust upon our party, the real choice of no one.
He described it as a matter of high principle. But this was cold politics. Reagan political director Charlie Black sums up the plan.
Well, we've named our running mate. Let's force Ford by the rules to name his, because we felt he had dangled the vice presidency to a lot of people in different states, and it made people be disappointed if he had to pick one of them.
All Reagan needed were a few disgruntled delegates to come over from Ford. Choosing a running mate might do it. If Ford picked a liberal, he'd upset his more conservative delegates, or vice versa. If he picked someone from the East, it might ruffle some delegates in the West. Sears called for a vote at the convention itself, by all of the delegates. They would decide on national television whether Gerald Ford would have to choose his vice president. It sounds silly, but this proposal, this paragraph, jeopardized Ford's nomination, and it would turn the 1976 Republican convention from a coronation into a shootout.
I remember it vividly.
Greg Willard, Ford's staff assistant.
There was still a lot of fluidity and lots of meetings and arm twisting going on. Mistakes were not an option. The count was that close.
And the math on this vote might favor Reagan. There were many delegates required to vote for Ford's nomination because he'd won their state's primaries, but on any other matter, they could side against him. And so, instantly, the entire campaign and the 76 convention centered on whether to add paragraph C to section 16 of the convention rulebook.
16C.
16C is really the name of the game.
16C. That was the mother lode for the convention.
The battle to lead the Republican Party and control its direction would be decided by a procedural vote about vice presidents. 16C.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
Gerald Ford stepped off Air Force One for the convention in Kansas City, smiling, waving, buoyant, confident. He traveled by presidential motorcade to his hotel, where a throng of cheering supporters awaited him.
This is the kind of enthusiasm that'll give us a victory on Wednesday night.
But many of the enthusiastic fans were actually campaign staff. It was designed to be a show of strength. The plane, the motorcade, reminders that he was the incumbent. Because behind his confident exterior, fear gnawed at Ford. Reagan's play, 16C, could undo his nomination. The president left the rally quickly and went up to his suite at the top of the hotel, including a room that looked like the Oval Office. From there, he launched into 3 days of arm-twisting, favor-trading meetings with delegates.
We were at battle stations every minute of the way in Kansas City, fighting for the last delegate.
His aides, Terry O'Donnell and Frank Urso Marso, recall bringing them up in batches.
Yeah, it was, you know, you don't sleep, you don't go to the bathroom, you don't eat, you don't do anything except get a delegate.
Mr. Ford's first full day here in Kansas City was full of politicking.
Wow, what a meeting!
They knew Reagan was fighting just as hard.
We need Reagan. We need Reagan.
The former governor slipped between service elevators to reach delegates in their hotel rooms and urge them to vote for 16C.
I think that you choose the nominee. You should choose both nominees.
He made it sound so reasonable, this sudden change to the rules.
I don't see if Mr. Ford can tell us who his suggestion would be on Thursday morning, why he can't tell us on Wednesday morning.
And yet, despite the blizzard of politicking, as the convention officially opened, still neither candidate had a clear majority, not on the nomination, not on 16C. And the fight between Reagan and Ford spilled onto the floor of the convention itself.
I now declare the 31st Republican National Convention in order.
The 18,000-seat arena in Kansas City filled with GOP politicians, Ford and Reagan campaign staff, delegates, and reporters. And none of them had any idea what was going to happen. Betsy Griffith, a Ford supporter, can still remember the feel of the convention.
The noise is overwhelming. It's like a roar. It's huge. It's hot.
There was great uncertainty. It was tense.
Ford aide Terry O'Donnell.
The Reagan supporters were everywhere, and they were more vocal.
They were extremely aggressive.
Audrey Rowe, chair of the National Women's Political Caucus and a Ford ally, says Reagan's imprint on the party was obvious. His screaming delegates were movement conservatives, former outsiders. Now they'd won their way into the party's power structure at the convention.
Is when I became much more aware of the polarization that was beginning to emerge.
You could also hear from the dais, in the official speeches, the two conflicting visions of what the Republican Party could be. Audrey Rowe spoke.
For me, the first time, look out at thousands of people. I had a chance to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment. I had a chance to talk about social justice.
She introduced the liberal outgoing vice president, Nelson Rockefeller.
I'm concerned about equal opportunity for all Americans.
The progressive Rockefeller had been pushed out as Ford's running mate due to the Reagan challenge.
This Republican Party of ours has been shrinking, not growing. We know we can have a broad-based appeal.
But speaker after speaker echoed Reagan's hard-right message.
There are those who would nationalize our economy and reduce all of us to a mass of mediocrity.
Delegates and everyone watching at home heard conspiracy theories promoted from the dais. For instance, a popular one, that thousands of American POWs were still in Vietnam abandoned.
Only God knows how many men are trying to stay alive.
The vote on 16C neared, and the tension ratcheted up. It ratcheted up because behind the fight over 16C, behind Ford versus Reagan, were the real stakes of this convention. You just heard them in the floor speeches. What kind of party would Republicans be? The broad tent that Ford and his allies wanted? Or a new, insular, hard-right party? The battle to decide was so close, anything might tip it, which led to pettiness and silliness. That was why you had one candidate in service elevators and the other trying to wear the entire White House as they tussled over a paragraph about vice presidential nominations. The silliness and the jockeying for any edge continued when the official debate on 16C began.
I have read this amendment. Therefore, I emphatically oppose it.
On the floor of the arena, cheers and boos competed as speakers on stage summoned righteous indignation for and against this rules change. But meanwhile, off the floor, the real fight over 16C, and therefore the nomination, and therefore who would lead the party, crystallized into a tug of war over just 30 votes, all from the same state. Reagan's aides thought these 30 votes could tip him the victory.
We did have a shot.
Reagan political director David Keene says it all boiled down to the delegates from Mississippi.
We're desperately trying to hold together the Mississippi delegation because they had adopted this unit rule thing.
This unit rule, it was more convention shenanigans. It required that the delegates vote as a block, determine internally which candidate to support, and then all of them would vote that way, thereby increasing their influence. Mississippi was the only state that had this rule, and it now looked like things were so close that whoever these 30 delegates decided to support would be the victor. Both Reagan and Ford had known this might be a possibility because of the unit rule. So both campaigns had worked on the Mississippi delegates for weeks.
The state of Mississippi, with its uncommitted delegation, looms large.
Reagan thought he had them. Mississippi was a deep South state, natural territory. But Ford's aides had gotten to the leader. His name was Clark Reed, and they whispered to him Reed could be the kingmaker who swung it all for Ford. Think what the president would owe him. Reed had begun leaning their way.
He couldn't stand up to the pressure.
So Ford thought he had Mississippi. But Reagan's team pushed back, and Clark Reed vacillated. Kennerly, the White House photographer.
He was like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall.
With the vote on 16C imminent, Reagan's staff hunted for Reed. They knew they needed his delegation. Ford's people also hunted for him. What was it going to be? Who would he choose? And Clark Reed hid. He didn't want to be the kingmaker anymore. Without leadership, the Mississippi delegation, expected to decide the nominee, instead fell apart into public bickering. One faction announced they were going to swing it for Ford.
Well, I want to go ahead and put the president over the top.
But Reagan's allies in the delegation said they could block the move.
They really don't have the count that they say they have.
Which meant, after all the scrutiny and tug of war, Mississippi's 30 votes were as fractured as the rest of the convention. And time had run out. On the convention floor, the vote on 16C was beginning.
The secretary will now call the roll. And may we please have order.
One last recap. This was the vote on the one-paragraph proposal cooked up by the Reagan campaign to force Ford to choose a vice president. If it passed, Reagan would almost certainly win the nomination.
This is a tense hall right now.
The two candidates watched from their hotel rooms, glued to their TVs, waiting to find out their fates.
Alabama.
Reagan wanted yeses. Ford wanted noes.
The great state of Alabama votes 37 votes yes.
Reagan gained an early advantage, one that grew quickly over Ford.
California proudly votes 166 yes, one no.
Reagan's lead seemed lopsided, but in fact, Ford was running ahead of projections in these early states.
Ford's now picked up a total of
Colorado.
3 votes.
He was winning more support than expected in states thought to be pro-Reagan, but it was close.
Ford picked up 3 votes there
Illinois,
as well, so he's now got a plus of 7 votes.
The roll call continued until it reached Mississippi.
Mississippi!
Finally, everyone would see where they stood. This was the crucial moment.
Mississippi passes.
They passed. Mississippi passed.
The delegates still couldn't decide. And more absurdity. It didn't matter. After all the lobbying and promising, Mississippi's votes were irrelevant. Because Ford kept picking up delegates. His supporters cheered as the no votes surpassed the yeses.
Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, cast 14 votes aye, 89 votes no.
And Reagan's support crumbled.
5 Reagan votes in Tennessee switched over to the Ford position.
As the last delegations not named Mississippi voted, Ford won.
The great Sunshine State has 38 votes no, 28 votes yes. I think that does it.
16C, plan number 2 from the Reagan campaign to win the nomination, had failed. And everyone in the hall could see that Gerald Ford had the votes to be his party's presidential candidate. The party would remain in his hands, a big tent. The conservative challenge had flopped. Or So it seemed.
Gerald Ford, who did not run for either the vice presidency or the presidency, will likely leave Kansas City as his party's legitimate nominee.
Ford's staff and supporters cheered. The president in his hotel room laughed, delighted. His campaign manager finally relaxed. It all looked like the president had clinched the nomination.
Do you see any booby traps now?
Frankly, I do not.
But there was a booby trap. While everyone was battling over 16C, Reagan's most conservative allies had been cooking up a third plan to challenge Ford. And unlike the procedural maneuvering of 16C, this challenge would be about belief. It would put Ford, his administration, and his ideology firmly in conservatives' crosshairs. The result sent the Republican Party hurtling to the right.
The ball game's not over. We have the ninth inning yet.
Something extraordinary was happening while the fight over 16C consumed all of the attention. Starting back before the convention, in those sweaty, smoke-filled meeting rooms, one of Reagan's closest allies, an incendiary right-wing senator, had cooked up his own plan.
Ever since he got here, Senator Helms has been in perpetual motion.
Jesse Helms thought if you want to fracture someone's support, don't bicker over rules. Find emotional issues, wedge issues. And so Helms spearheaded an effort to insert polarizing, conservative stances into the Republican Party platform on an array of issues.
The issue of court-ordered busing.
The subject was the Panama Canal, which is
in favor of school prayer.
Amnesty, gun control, national health.
The platform, like the party, had traditionally avoided hard right positions, especially on social issues. Now Helms gathered conservative delegates and activists to change that. Republicans had supported the Equal Rights Amendment since the 1940s. The anti-feminist Phil Schlafly called for the platform committee to reject it.
If you take a stand against ERA, you can neutralize the public resentment that exists today against President and Mrs. Gerald Ford because of their intimate involvement with the radical women's lib movement.
Kansas Senator Bob Dole proposed a plank that had never been in either party's platform ever before.
And the language is this: we oppose the widespread practice of abortion on demand, as well as the use of federal funds to pay for abortions.
ERA and abortion opponents packed into the room, waving signs and graphic pictures of aborted fetuses. The vitriol caught feminists off guard, including Betsy Griffith, who was part of the official Republican Women's Task Force.
It may have been some of the first exposure to the posters with the photographs and the shouting about being baby killers or murderers. You know, these nice lady Republican delegates were not used to being shouted at with words like that.
And it put pressure on Gerald Ford to do something. After all, he could fight these changes to the platform. He didn't want them, didn't agree with them, and they were politically unpopular. For instance, at the time, polls showed the public supported the ERA 2-1, and Republicans favored abortion rights more than Democrats. So Ford could rally his delegates and fight Jesse Helms and the conservatives. He'd probably win. But that's what Jesse Helms was counting on. This was plan number three. A fight over the platform would be divisive, messy, and very, very public. Once again, Ford would risk alienating his most conservative supporters, driving them to Reagan. He had one other option: surrender. He could simply not fight.
They thought I would be sucker enough to take the bait, and we fooled them.
This is Ford recalling his thought process to his biographer.
I was looking at winning, and my view was, who the hell's going to worry about that platform? I'm not going to go by it. I'm not going to be bound by it. First, you got to get the nomination. You have to win the ballgame.
The debate over the platform culminated on the floor of the convention after the vote on 16C.
The ball game's not over. We have the ninth inning yet.
Jesse Helms brought one final platform change before all of the delegates. He called for a vote, just like 16C, but this one would enshrine criticisms of Ford's foreign policy into the platform.
I ask you,
Are we really willing to give away the Panama Canal?
This was devious. This was a direct personal insult. And if Ford allowed it to pass, his party's own platform would condemn him. It would be humiliating. And Ford knew it.
I was goddamn mad.
Aides urged him to take a stand. But once again, that's what Helms wanted. The goal of these platform fights was to split his support in the razor-close battle for the nomination.
But I said, we don't have a choice. Here are the votes. Do you want to lose this vote and then lose the nomination? Because that probably would have been the sequence.
And so, on the floor of the convention, when this deeply personal attack against him came up for a vote, Ford ordered his allies to support it.
All in favor of the amendment will say aye.
Ford let this insult against him pass into the platform.
In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. The ayes have it, and it is so ordered.
In the committee rooms, where abortion and school prayer were up for debate, Ford did the same, surrendered, which avoided splitting his support. By not fighting, he defused the third and final plan to scuttle his nomination. He would be the nominee. But it also meant, when the dust settled, the Republican Party, for the first time officially, stood opposed to abortion, gun registration, in favor of prayer in school and the death penalty. Only one proposal failed, the challenge to the Equal Rights Amendment. Feminists in the party beat it back in a tight committee vote.
But it was a very narrow, hard fight. Four votes.
Liberal Republicans, including Betsy Griffith and Audrey Rowe, felt sold out, even if they understood the president's calculus.
I was disappointed. I kept being told, Audrey, you know where the president stands. We just need to make sure that we get through the convention.
The compromises that the Ford people made, not wanting to go to floor fights, not willing to push, we felt betrayed us. Feminists felt betrayed us. Winning the presidency is the most important thing. But how much do you do to win it?
Gerald Ford figured he was allowing the conservative movement a temporary, meaningless victory on a piece of paper no one would care about, instead of control of the party. But this also ended up a turning point. The Republican Party was on the record as a conservative party. And it would soon be clear that was more than just paperwork.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
The official nomination happened the next night. It was close, but easy, devoid of tension or further battles.
The chair declares that the nominee of this convention for the presidency of the United States is Gerald R. Ford.
The unelected president, Jerry Ford, won his party's nomination. He became the first and only politician ever to beat Ronald Reagan in a political campaign. He appeared on the stage for the first time on the final night of the convention. He walked out with his wife, Betty Ford, waving as cheers rained down from their supporters. The Reagans watched from a box in the stands and clapped politely. Ford stepped up to the microphone, and the often awkward, stumbling president was fiery.
We concede not a single state. We concede not a single vote.
He was starting the general election campaign far behind in the polls. But Ford was defiant, optimistic.
I faced many tough problems. I probably made some mistakes. But on balance, America and Americans have made an incredible comeback since August 1974.
Ford considered it his best speech, and it was well-received, even by Reagan supporters.
It was a pretty good speech. You know, I mean, Jerry Ford's not a great orator, but the speech was pretty good. Pretty good.
Frank Donatelli had been an advisor to Reagan, and like many at the convention, he was still reeling from his candidate's loss and what it meant.
We're just devastated by this. What you have to understand is Reagan is now 64 years old. He would be 68 years old if he would ever run again. And in those days, that was too old. So we all thought this was it. This was the best chance we would have to elect a conservative.
The conservative movement thought it had lost, possibly forever. But then, Ford finished his pretty good speech, and amid the cheers and the band playing, the president unexpectedly stepped back up to the microphone. He wanted to unite his party, ensure Reagan's conservatives supported him rather than his Democratic opponent, which it looked like they might. So Ford called to Reagan in the stands and asked him to come down to the stage.
Reagan didn't want to do it, but the crowd keeps chanting and everything, and finally he gives in.
Then on stage, Ford, looking for his opponent's words of goodwill, offered Reagan the microphone.
I would be honored on your behalf to ask my good friend, Governor Reagan, to say a few words at this time.
It was an unprecedented break from tradition, and Reagan was unprepared. Ford had sent him a message that he planned to do just this, but Reagan's aides hadn't believed it. They thought the messenger was drunk. That's how unprecedented this was. Reagan stepped up to the microphone. He stalled. What should he say?
Mr. President, Mrs. Ford, Mr. Vice President, Mr. Vice President-to-be.
He paused for a moment, a deep intake of breath. Then he focused not on praising his former opponent, but on the platform. This, he said, was the signature victory at this convention.
I believe the Republican Party has a platform that is a banner of bold, unmistakable colors with no pale pastel shades.
Still, he was searching for the meat of what he wanted to say. And then he found it. You could hear him switch. There was a speech Reagan had been preparing for a different upcoming event, but it could work here. He transitioned into it.
If I could just take a moment and I had an assignment the other day. Someone asked me to write a letter for a time capsule that is going to be opened in Los Angeles 100 years from now, on our tricentennial.
It seemed like Reagan was talking off the cuff as he found beautiful, powerful imagery.
It sounded like an easy assignment. They suggested I write something about the problems and issues of the day, and I set out to do so, riding down the coast in an automobile, looking at the blue Pacific out on one side and the Santa Ynez Mountains on the other, and I couldn't help but wonder if it was going to be that beautiful 100 years from now as it was on that summer day.
This would become another famous, iconic speech in a career littered with them. But what strikes me most about it is it was nearly identical in theme and message to the 30-minute ad that had spurred his comeback against Ford in North Carolina, or to the very first speech that propelled him onto the national stage in the mid-1960s. He once again talked of imminent totalitarianism.
The erosion of freedom that has taken place under Democrat rule in this country. The invasion of private rights.
He described a struggle between heroes and villains, patriots against communists, abroad and at home.
And if we fail, they probably won't get to read the letter at all because it spoke of individual freedom, and they won't be allowed to talk of that or read of it.
It was the same rhetoric that had been dismissed for more than a decade as conspiratorial, doomsaying, fringe. But now, speaking after the President of the United States, the defeated candidate Ronald Reagan drew the most passionate, thunderous cheers of the convention.
There is no substitute for victory. Mr. President.
You could not take in that ovation and not think that the last chapter hasn't been written yet.
Reagan's campaign workers all tell stories about this moment. Here's North Carolina's Carter Wren.
I passed this woman standing in the aisle crying. She had on a Ford button. And she looked at me and she said, "We picked the wrong guy."
Gerald Ford had won the nomination. Ronald Reagan had won the Republican Party. Republicans would, from here on, permanently turn to the right. But the change in the country's politics was actually far more profound than that. The same distrust of government and backlash that had propelled Reagan's presidential bid also influenced the Democratic Party. There, in the Democrats' primaries, another ideological battle was taking shape.
I think we're ready for a new generation of leadership.
More than a dozen contenders jockeyed for the Democratic nomination, and a nearly unknown former governor rocketed through the field to shift his party to the right.
The insiders have had their chance, and they have not delivered. And their time has run out.
Next time on Landslide, Jimmy Carter, the humble peanut farmer, the cold-blooded political knife fighter, the populist conservative, upsets the Democratic field. You can see a full bibliography for this episode on our show page at wfae.org/landslide. Landslide is a production of Nuance Tales. It is created, hosted, reported, produced, and written by me, Ben Bradford. Edited by Rick Carr. Engineering and sound design by Jay Siebold. Our music is composed and performed by Matt Bradford. Hannah Luck created the cover art. Landslide is produced in partnership with WFAE. Greg Collard and Eli Portillo provided editorial support and strategic guidance. Web design and marketing support by Jen Lang and Lena Hong. Judon Marshall is the CEO at WFAE. The podcast is distributed by the NPR Network. Thanks to Dan McCoy, Lindsay McKenna, Gary DeWong, and the rest of the team at NPR. To see more about Landslide, visit our website at wfae.org/landslide.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.